about I've heard about that name or the terminology brownfield. That's good, that's good. Yeah, because yeah, you'll be surprised, you know. You ask people brownfield, they have no idea what you're talking about. So that's the definition of, you know, brownfield. According to EPA, you know, EPA defines brownfields as real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse, which may be complicated by the presence of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. And according to EPA, there are about, you know, 450,000 brownfields in the United States, and most, you know, can be found in minority and or low-income neighborhoods. A brownfield may be as simple as an abandoned gas station, or as complicated as an abandoned factory. And the factory becomes a financial burden when a new owner inherits the responsibility of having underground and or above ground storage tanks removed and the contaminated soil and groundwater remediated. Well, many US cities are stable one will show, you can go to the next one. You cannot see, you know, all those figures over there, but you know, I will point out, you know, some of the cities to you. How many of you here are from Atlanta? Let you see how many brownfields are in Atlanta. That's right. For, you know, I'm just going to pick up some just few cities for you. For Atlanta, there are about 351 brownfields, and equivalent to about 684 estimated acres. So you have about, you know, 351 brownfields occupying about 684 acres of land. Another city that, you know, I'm showing over here, just kind of, you know, picking out some of the few cities. Austin, anybody from Austin, Texas? Nobody from Austin, Texas. Well, Austin, Texas has about, you know, 305 brownfields and estimated acres of 3,200. And somebody will say, how come Atlanta has 351 and it only has 684 acres of brownfield? It depends on the size of the brownfields, of course. Probably in Atlanta, many of the probably most of the brownfields are, you know, gas stations. Compared to maybe Austin, which might have, you know, more factories, abandoned factories, maybe factories that move overseas, you know, just shut down, move overseas. You know, so they have, you know, more of, you know, acreage of, you know, brownfield. Chicago, how many people from Chicago? Yeah, I used to teach in Chicago. That's what, you know, Chicago has about, you know, 500 brownfields. They're occupying about, you know, 2,500 acres. Anyone from Cleveland, Ohio? No one from Cleveland, Ohio. You know, for those of you, you know, who were born or you were around in the 70s, you know, you probably heard about, you know, Cuyahoga Lake catching fire. You know, you know, at that time, you know, everything has been cleaned up now. I used to live in Ohio too, by the way. Cleveland has about, you know, 200 brownfields, occupying about 3,000 acres of land. And of course, you know, from, you know, this introduction, you will see that, you know, so many of those cities are cities that are, you know, you can find a whole lot, you know, black population or even a Latino population. But it's not only exclusive to where a whole lot of, you know, black people are, though. For example, let's look at, you know, Dumont, Iowa. There are not many black people in Dumont, Iowa. You know, there are a few Latinos too. But let's look at Dumont, Iowa. Dumont, Iowa has about, you know, 1,730 brownfields occupying about 2,000 acres of land. And somebody will say, you know, how come Dumont, Iowa? You know, probably has, you know, a lot of, you know, abandoned factories. Again, you know, people move jobs overseas, so they have, you know, a lot of abandoned properties that probably have to be cleaned up. And then Detroit, anyone from Detroit? No one from the Motor City, that's right. Detroit. Yeah, Detroit has about, you know, 1,000 brownfields, you know, occupying 10,000 acres of land. So you probably, you know, see a lot of, you know, bordered properties in Detroit. You know, of course, you know, Detroit is undergoing depression as well. Let's see. How many people here from New York City? New York City ranks number one, actually, in number of, you know, brownfields. And, you know, New York City, 6,000 brownfields occupying 7,600 acres of land. New York City, not New York State, New York City.
That's right.
And the least of all the series is Skokie, Illinois. Anyone from Skokie, Illinois? Yeah, you know, in a suburb of Chicago. Skokie has just in one brownfield and 2 acres of land. So that's how, you know, many of the series rank. Next slide, please. Let's continue with the slide, please. What are some of the problems or challenges associated with brownfields? Of course, you know, some of those problems are, you know, environmental / ecological. Abandoned buildings can become neighborhood drug labs. Imagine living in Detroit, having about 10,000 or so boarded places. I mean, they become, drug labs, even hangout for some drug dealers and users. There's also the potential, for soil, water, and air contamination due to abandoned tanks, drums, etc. Second, financial, cost of assessment and cleanup of, contaminated property, removal of, storage tanks, drums, and debris, will become a challenge. Health, of course, increased risk of birth defects, and chronic diseases such as, lung cancer, asthma, etc. Because some of these series, that we mentioned, New York City, Chicago, Cleveland, for many of you have been looking at, the rate of asthma, them also, have, high, they are top of the list, top 10 in, asthma cases, and so on and so forth. So, many of these, abandoned properties, could be associated with the risk of bad defects, chronic diseases, such as, lung cancer, asthma, etc. Because of the contamination, of course. Legal / regulatory challenge. Current or future owners of brownfields may be liable for cleanup and fines in some situations. So those are, the four typical challenges, to brownfield development. Next, please. Our benefits of, brownfield restoration, that is, where I want to focus more on in terms of, promoting environmental justice, and environmental, environmental quality. This is about, turning lemon into lemonade by converting brownfields to usable parklands, educational facilities, government / commercial buildings, industrial and manufacturing facilities, parking spaces, stadiums, halls for transportation, retail stores, housing development, etc. When restoration is successfully done, the entire community benefits economically, environmentally, and healthfully. What we want to do is, develop or redevelop, some of these, brownfields. They can be developed. I used to teach at Chicago State. For those of you from Chicago, familiar with Chicago State, that property used to be a brownfield, where Chicago State is right now. Chicago State, it's been there for 20, 30 years now. So brownfield can be turned into some, reusable property. Next slide, please. Well, these are a number of jobs created from brownfield development. That, if you start to invest in brownfield development, there are a lot of benefits. During the initial stage of, development, environmental assessment, and so on and so forth, that could lead to some jobs. So pre-development could lead to about, 71,288 jobs. Post-development could result into about, 115,624 jobs, if resources are actually devoted to brownfield development. And there is also the potential for about, 191,238 jobs, if brownfield sites are properly developed and restored. Next slide, please. Well, where can you find some assistance from brownfield development? As a matter of fact, the stimulus plan, you'll hear about, the stimulus plan all the time. There are so many things that, the stimulus plan, has been very, very useful. Many people don't know. Many of these grants, came from the, the economic, stimulus grant, from the federal government. And these are some of the areas, where people can tap into. Either, the cities, entrepreneurs, and so on and so on, can tap into some of the federal grants here to actually try to do something about, brownfields in their area. The U.S. Housing and Urban Development has a grant that, you know, people could tap into to help, you know, employ low and moderate income minorities for brownfield redevelopment. That is the website, you know, where you can access, you know, HUD for that kind of grant. And EPA, of course, you know, the foremost environmental protection agency in the country, has a series of, you know, of grants. There's a $200,000 grant for inventory, assessment, planning, and community development for whoever applies, you know, for that kind of a grant. There's a five-year, $1 million grant, you know, to support other grants, you know. There's a three-year, $200,000 grant for cleanup of contaminated sites. And EPA also has a $2.6 million grant to states to promote environmental job training to residents or communities impacted by brownfields. So, and that is the website for EPA, if you. And then, of course, you know, DHHS, you know, also has a grant called Brownfield Minority Worker Training Program. And this grant can also, you know, be assessed, you know, through, you know, if you are looking at a DHHS grant. Next slide, please. Well, impact of, you know, brownfield development on environmental justice and minority health. As stated earlier, most brownfields are found in minority and or low-income neighborhoods where environmental degradation and health disparities exist. You know, therefore, restoring or redeveloping these sites can only be a possible thing, in my opinion. As more of these sites are remediated and developed, the lower will be the risk for air, soil, and water contamination. Less environmental burden, in turn, will lower the burden of environmentally induced diseases. So the more we clean up, you know, or develop or redevelop any of these brownfield areas, the less will be the environmental burden for people who live in those areas. And so the lower will be the burden of environmentally induced diseases. There are even prospects for minorities and poor people living in close proximity to brownfield to play an active role in governmental funded remediation and job training from brownfield restoration. Under this scenario, victims of brownfields will actually become beneficiaries of the cleanup. You know, simply put, municipalities and entrepreneurs can tap into federal grants to turn trash into cash, an opportunity for community revitalization. Conclusion and recommendations. Considering the number of brownfields in the United States, it is encouraging that, you know, steps have been taken to remediate and restore many of these properties, at least close to their original form. Brownfield acquisition for development is not merely restoring and revitalizing neighborhoods. It is also limiting environmental burden of diseases and promoting environmental justice in affected communities. To continue making progress in environmental restoration and promotion of environmental justice and pollution prevention, the following are my recommendations. An interest in environmental activism is seriously needed in poor and minority neighborhoods to make government and corporate leaders do the right thing. You know, my experience is that, you know, in many black communities, you know, people are not, you know, being environmentally active, you know, because, you know, people, you know, like, you know, people say all the time, you know, people have to be concerned about, you know, where their next meal is coming from. They don't have no time for environmental activism. You know? But, you know, we need to, you know, to do more in terms of, you know, getting people really active in their communities. More involvement of, you know, local and state governments to partake in federal grants for community restoration and training of neighborhood youths for green and related environmental jobs in this global economy. Last but not the least, more minority students are needed in the environmental health sciences field so that they can someday become teachers, practitioners, scientists, and activists. As more African Americans and Latinos enter the environmental public health profession, they will undoubtedly play pivotal roles in protecting the communities most called home. Having the knowledge and understanding of the relationship between environmental exposure and disease will help protect communities from the burden of environmental degradation and injustice. And for somebody like me, you know, I've taught environmental health, you know, for about 25 years. You know, most of my classes, you know, even after 25 years, I could count the number of minority students in my classes in 25 years. They're probably not even up to 20. it's good, you know. I mean, it's good to go to health education and health administration and all those things. You know, they are fine. But I usually encourage that, you know, even if you go into all those areas, at least you know, pick some classes in other areas. That's right. So that at least, because, you know, everything is interrelated. So you know where everybody is coming from. You're coming from epidemiology, you have an understanding. Environmental health, you have your understanding. You know, so you know, many minority students, especially the black students, don't go into environmental health. But they complain about, oh, too technical, too much chemistry, so on and so forth. You know, that is the reason why many of us, in terms of being environmentally active, you know, as teachers, you know, we can encourage them right from grade school. You know, to take these classes, do that, do all this kind of stuff. So that when they get to the level where they start picking major, at least give environmental health some consideration. Like Dr. Jenkins said yesterday, because of listening to him. He said, well, it's okay for people to go into health education, health administration, but he wish everybody would go to epidemiology, right? And power statistics. I would say the same thing. I wish everybody would go into environmental health. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thanks to all the presenters. This was a fabulous session. We don't have enough time to probably get in all the questions that you have. I know I have questions myself, but I'm here to moderate, so I won't monopolize the time. And I don't know if I introduced myself. I'm Dr. Jamila Rashid. I'm the Associate Director for Research and Policy in the HHS Office of Minority Health. And I'm in Washington, D.C., so I'm definitely interested in following up with you about what you're talking about. Not because I'm from there, but I'm there now. I'm actually from Chicago. So, who has a question? And if you could just identify who your question is for, I'll take the first lady in with the black sweater or dress on.
Hello, my name is Allison Davis. My question is for all of you collectively, because each of your work contributes significantly to the minority population. I'm wondering, however, because I see a lack of involvement, as many of you mentioned, from these populations, how do you disseminate the information of your findings in order to motivate and encourage these populations to make a change or to get involved in the community and what's going on?
We probably can't have each one of them answer, so who's like dying to answer this question?
I'll say, for me, what I have done, I've served as a member of Big Brother, Big Sister, where I live right now in Columbia, Missouri. I also serve as a mentor. So once a week I go into some of the elementary schools, on a weekly basis, throughout the school year. So I talk about all the different areas, work with the kids, So ask them questions. What do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And stuff like that. So when they start talking about other things, I try to tell them, there are so many other opportunities, if you're not successful here, these are other things that you can do. So that's some of the things that I have done personally. And also, every now and again, I make presentation to groups of campus, in college student fraternities and sororities. So we get to send me some of this information.
Anyone else want to just touch on that?
So can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that one thing that's really fascinating about the work that I do is I think it tends to be sometimes, we still have some of the challenges, but we tend to advocate that people are engaged, just finding that nugget or the thing that is like at their highest priority to like really engage them around. And so I work at a community-based organization, but also I work with like networks of other like environmental justice or environmental health focused community-based organizations. And so many of the things that end up happening is really like either engaging youth or engaging like older folks, or it just depends on the level or like, I don't know, what club they might be in. Because we've had like a lot of engagement around like just specific issues. So there may be like a building who's having like tons of like pest and pesticide issues. And so initially those folks may not want to come to something that's like, talking about like, you have like this level of pesticide that's impacting you, like a sign. scientific talk, but they are going to want to talk to somebody about how, like, they can address some of the issues around rats. So I think, like, sometimes it's recognizing that some of the populations that we call, like, easy, like, hard to, like, access populations are actually the ones that sometimes are easy to miss, because we're also not, like, meeting people where they are, which I think is something that, like, sometimes, you know, is hard, but it just depends on also your capacity. So, like, that's not something that maybe, like, a person at, like, a public health department could do. Sorry. Or, like, someone at a university, but if you begin to, like, find ways to begin to, like, synergize resources, so, like, I can work with the person at the public health department, and, like, they can implement and do some of, like, the data analysis and look at some of the more broad, like, policy issues within their department, and then, like, we could organize some residents to go and talk with, like, some of the talking points that, like, they have. So I think that that's just something to like, remember. And then, like, also, I mean, a lot of this work is work that, you know, you're saying, okay, I'm invested in this for the long haul.
Okay. So I saw a body reaction from her, and I had a similar body reaction. You know, it all depends on a person's perspective and where they're coming from when they engage in that work. I worked at in the university and in the community and from the federal government perspective, and, you know, able to do a lot of what you described, and what you do is all on how you approach the situation. Yes, you were next.
Yeah, I had a question or comment about the brownfield situation. I think it's pretty clear that to clean those parcels up, it, you know, can only benefit the community's health and quality of life in general. However, the concerns that I keep running into is that tension between the cost of doing a good cleanup and knowing what a good cleanup is, because a lot of the sites are very complicated, and the cost of a developer bringing the project to fruition. So there's a tension, and I think an inherent conflict in there, conflict of interest. And so that, you know, what I'm always grappling with is how do we monitor these cleanups? How do we get the skills, the knowledge, the resources to monitor these cleanups so those same communities aren't re-exposed when that dirt is dug up, when that that pump and treat, that water is sent down, like old infrastructure, the sewers are old, and then that water gets underneath people's homes, okay? And so there's a real concern. And then the third thing is that how long will these sort of caps last? I mean, depending on the quality, it's really kind of untested technology. I know that you cited one of the schools. And is there a way to require that ongoing monitoring, you know, of vapors that could come through? So I think there's a lot of issues with doing the remediation, and I'm concerned that how do we find the resources that help us be vigilant, like community groups, like make sure that the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and aren't going to run it. I mean, there's one brownfield site in South Philadelphia, and they took away the public housing authority. So they displaced all of the people living there, and those people lost their homes. So there's a lot of...
Sure. Yeah, in terms of you know, monitoring, actually that is where the big deal, you know, comes in.
But if it's not a Superfund site, it's only a local brownfield site,
sure.
EPA might not be involved.
Yeah, you know, but from my own experience, because I used to work for the county health department in Riverside, California, and we actually took care of the local ones, yeah, the health department. And actually that was part of my job, because my title was a hazardous material management specialist. You know, so people like me monitor those local brownfields, and you know, in terms of the regulations, you know, and we follow pretty much the cleanup guidelines, you know, in terms of determining how clean is clean. So you cannot just go there and do whatever you want to do. You know, you have to have a regulatory oversight. So at the local level, the health department, even the state health department can get involved. So, and in terms of, you know, the people who work in the area, OSHA, you know, either the state OSHA or the federal OSHA, you know, can get involved in terms of, you know, even keeping the people who work on the site safe. And in terms of, you know, community impact, this is where ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, that is their territory, to make sure those who live in those communities are not impacted negatively by that brownfield cleanup. So there are so many agencies that can get involved because, you know, but many of them will start at the local level.
My question is to Dr. Nancy. Under the award, I'm from the Atlanta, and Greenfield is
not too bad.
Yeah, but I work for the health department, and our health department there, we do a lot of outreach. Actually, I've built several different coalitions in the community. But what you said that was really important, I think, was the fact that you all have involved the environmental licensing department of the health department. I wanted to know, was that something that you in your administrative duties did, or you all formed a coalition, or how did you gather to get them involved? Because they're in our building, but I've never made that contact or connection.
I sit across the table every Tuesday from that director. So it's very easy in our health department. We have six administrations. Some much larger than others. The smallest is 43. Has 43 employees. The largest has over 200 employees. But we all meet every Tuesday. And I, part of the concept that we have in the health department isn't just about intra-agency collaboration, but also inter-agency collaboration. So with our with the leadership of the city currently and with our director, we've developed something called the Live Well DC team, and we have a corresponding community coalition. And our Live Well DC team has senior leadership from many agencies in the district, which is either the director or their designee, sometimes their chief of staff, but transportation, planning, economic development, housing, schools, healthcare finance, which is a Medicaid administration, and different parts of the Department of Health, we all meet on a monthly basis. If we don't meet in person, we meet virtually. And some of the issues that we're addressing early on are related to tobacco prevention and control, as well as obesity prevention. And to that end, we have a corresponding community coalition, which has 9 seats, and they were all elected. It totals about 18 representatives, because each seat has a primary and a secondary person, and it spans from commerce to healthcare to education, such as PTAs, et cetera. But they're all the community counterpart to the government piece. And what that allows us to do is, in our government space, we can hash out the little policy, organizational policy things that need to happen in order to develop healthier communities. And then when we're meeting with the community, they help to inform us in terms of their work. Many of those people in our community coalition lead larger community-based organizations or are members of some of the larger primary care or healthcare trade associations in the District of Columbia. So, you know, we're fostering the spirit of collaboration, and our approach, and why I think has been so successful, is we don't tell people what to do. We don't go to transportation and say, you should care about public health. We ask transportation what they're doing, and then we get them to understand that what they're doing is public health. And then as a result, we get to hash out, well, that doesn't seem like the right thing to do from a public health perspective. So sort of this informal opportunity to do health assessments or health and all policy assessments.
So in terms of the licensing and promoting adoption of, you know, whatever guidelines are, and you're not in the health department, this young lady here, how might she?
So I went, our DC Department of Consumer Regulatory Affairs is what actually licenses businesses in the District of Columbia and every type of business. Sometimes you have to get a DCRA license and then another license on top of that. For example, healthcare facilities, you have to have one from them and one from the Department of Health. I actually physically went over and met with their chief of staff and said, this is what we are trying to do, and I understand that you're a revenue-driven agency. So the more licenses you sell for some things, which may be bad, but the more licenses you sell, the more revenue you generate, which then helps to pay your salary. So open the part of the conversation, I get it, money matters, but what are some of the other revenue generating options we can talk about that wouldn't have as much adverse impacts on our community? So, I think the approach is to not beat people over the head with public health, because that scares a lot of people, and a lot of people think that the health departments, be these either local or state health departments, are the only entities responsible for health in their jurisdiction. So if you go beating them over their head with public health, they're gonna tell you, well, that's your job, and you should do it better, as opposed to really getting them to understand that it's more about interagency collaborations and more about us all working together to address the social determinants of health.
Okay, great. Any other questions out there?
In your presentation, you said something about how, you know, when you're working with communities and you don't focus on
that it's all bad. Can you talk more about that?
So what I meant by that is, I guess, framing it in terms of, like, what are certain positive things that we can identify, like, within our community in terms of, like, thinking about community, like, asset mapping that we can begin to build on, as opposed to always, like, saying, like, well, here's the problem, and we know we have a problem, and these are the health outcomes associated with it. And then sometimes that just makes people, I think in some ways, feel, like, more apathetic. So I think it's, like, you know, identifying, you know, here are some assets that we have, either, like, with different folks that are within, like, the broader, like, stakeholder collaborative, whether they be at, like, the public health department or at, like, a university, or maybe even they're like, I don't know, their own, like, local entrepreneur, and figuring out ways that they can begin to identify, like, I can be empowered in this way to be able to make a change, and these are the groups of people that I can work with, and then this is how we can address it to, I think, move forward to build, like, a healthy community.
All right, thanks. Well, we're out of time, but you're welcome after we end to come up and ask any of the presenters for other questions or for their information to contact them. We want to thank you for coming to our session.